Welcome to Mortgage Space. I'm your host, Alan Medeiros, and today we have Cecile Shanklin from Tycor Title. Cecile and I have been friends, but also business colleagues for over 10 years now. But she has a lot more experience than I do in title, escrow, real estate. She's been in the industry for over 35 years and has had the experiences from managing a real estate office to sales and listings to title and escrow. And she hangs her hat presently with Tycor Title, one of the largest corporations in title industry throughout the United States with the FNF companies, correct?
Correct.
And I thank you so much, Cecile, for taking your time. I really wanted to bring quality people to sit down and talk about things that are just not as easy to understand. I think people go through a process, but not sure why they go through the process.
Absolutely.
So today we're going to debunk some of those myths that may be out there about why you go through title and escrow. Maybe explain the differences to what an escrow is versus maybe in states that use attorneys, right? So we call ourselves an escrow state, so we're going to discuss stuff like that. But we're also going to go through kind of A to Z, the process of a real estate transaction, so that the listeners have a better idea of what they're going to experience when they purchase a home, because you have the mortgage pre-qualification, you have the exciting nature of getting that pre-qual letter to a real estate agent, finding a home, and then they get an offer accepted, and then the magic begins, I like to say, right? Now it's go time. So you're a big football fan, right? The most exciting part of a football career is the beginning of that game, or the beginning of the next quarter, or the beginning of the next half, right? But we're all looking towards that 2-minute warning, because that is go time. We need to close out this transaction. That's where really the exciting part comes, and sometimes the most stressful parts. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
So let's go ahead and start out. Tell me what title and escrow is.
Okay, well, title and escrow are actually two different things. As an escrow company, we are a disinterested third party. We carry out all the terms and conditions of the real estate contract. As a title company, we search the title on that property. We go back in the books. We look who's owned the property, who owns it now. Are there liens against it? Are there deeds of trust against it? So that we make sure when we transfer that title that the new owner gets the title, a good title, clear title.
So why do we need this process? What can I just go over to a buyer and say, hey, I've got a property to sell, you want to buy it, just give me this amount of money and I will go ahead and sign the property over to you?
Well, believe me, people have done that, but they've been sorry they've done that.
And why were they sorry?
Okay, what happens is when you go to somebody and say, hey, I want to buy your property, and they say, okay, buy my property. If I merely give you the money and you sign the property over and no title search was done, I could end up owing money that you owed and I have to pay it off when I go to sell the property. If there's judgments against people, if there's deeds of trust on the property, if there's tax liens, child support liens, all those things attach to the property and must be satisfied before that property is transferred. And if you don't have an escrow and title company, that doesn't get done, and all of those liens go onto the new buyer, and they then have those liens.
We're going to talk about that in the oops part of this transaction, kind of at the end of the podcast, but you and I have had so many different experiences in real estate transactions, you probably more so than I, because you see things that happen outside of my sphere of influence. And I can tell you that having an understanding of why clear title is important becomes immeasurably important to an owner of real estate. So we'll talk about that later in the podcast, and I want to give you some opportunity to tell me some of those oops moments, meaning people that did stupid things and are paying for it dearly for not using the escrow process and having clear title. So let's go back a little bit and talk about, who are the players involved in a real estate transaction? So can you kind of name off the top of your head some basic players that are involved in their process?
Absolutely. Well, we have the listing agent. Mm-hmm. We have the selling agent, which is the buyer's agent. Mm-hmm. We have the lender. Mm-hmm. We have the escrow officer and any assistants. But we also have the ancillary people like the pest control person or the septic tank inspector or the appraiser, the home inspector, there's lots of different people who round out the whole transaction. So it's very important that everyone work together on the transaction to get it done.
So can you, you left one out, which was important, as a title officer.
Correct.
So what is the distinction between escrow officer and a title officer?
An escrow officer is the one who takes the contract, make sure everything on that contract is taken care of before we transfer the title. The title officer is the person who goes back and researches the title to see if there are liens on it, to see who really owns it, to see if it was properly transferred the last few times it was transferred, to make sure all the deeds of trust were paid off in previous transfers, to make sure taxes were paid, all of those things.
So what I always look at is, in the beginning of a transaction, we order something called a preliminary title report. That is issued by the title officer.
Correct.
The title officer's name is on there, meaning they're the ones that issued this preliminary title report, meaning they've taken the time to do the research and compile this report for the lender's benefit and also the buyer and seller. Mm-hmm. So when I look at the preliminary title report, there's a few key things that I zero in on. Number one, the owner of record matching the name on the contract.
Correct.
Huge deal, right? Second thing I look at is current taxes. Is the property delinquent in any taxes or any supplemental bills that were not paid? Are there any outstanding items that are leaning on this property? The third thing I look at is outstanding liens that may be a mortgage that's outstanding, perhaps a second. If there was a judgment that was filed and recorded against that property, or perhaps even a UCC filing for solar or some other type of a fixture, as they call it, a mechanics lien. These are all important pieces mm-hmm. that, if discovered early enough in the process, it'll reduce the headaches.
Absolutely.
Because if we don't clear those liens, I can tell you this, we won't lend on that property.
That is exactly it.
And I think that a lot of consumers don't realize that all this research is being done on the behalf of the buyer as well.
Correct.
We need to protect them, mm-hmm. but the bank also wants to make sure we have clear title. Mm-hmm. There are documents that are very clear in what we sign that actually state we will not allow any junior liens to sit behind our first trust deed unless it was approved.
Correct.
So it could be a down payment assistance program. It could be some other type of second mortgage that was a combination type of loan. But those are all important things to investigate. And I can tell you, and this is one of those oops moments, I'll bring it up early. I've had experiences where a listing agent did not do their due diligence, listed the property, got it into contract only to find out that there were child support liens against the seller, tax implications for things that needed to have been paid but weren't paid and now are leaning on the property. Other issues that may have come up, we talked about child support. Mm-hmm. I've also seen this, PACE and HERO liens.
Oh.
These are huge because they have to be cleared now. Previously, we were able to be subordinated. They will not allow that anymore. And it's very, very important that a seller know exactly what they have to pay off because they may change their mind about selling that property if they cannot net enough money out or if they have to come to the table and close the transaction.
That's why I always tell listing agents, before you do anything, get a property profile on that property and make sure the HERO loans, the PACE loans, they can be deadly in transactions.
Absolutely.
They are huge amounts of money, and it can take any profit that Mr. Seller is walking away with and flush it right down the toilet. So it's very important.
And on top of that, it's publicly embarrassing, I think, in a way, because let's just say you did take a listing, you did get it in a contract, you find out this stuff later in the event. Now you have a buyer that's excited about buying your home, is willing to pay the price that you agreed upon, only to be told, I'm sorry,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to work. I apologize for taking your time, or no response at all.
Exactly.
They just walk away and everyone thinks that nothing happened. There are precious hours that are taken out of real estate professionals' time showing property in 100-plus degree weather,
oh,
right?
Yes.
They make all these offers. They're taking time with their family. They're doing things that traditionally would be earmarked for other things in their life, but they want to serve their client only to find out that they couldn't do it. I think it's really emotionally draining as well. And some people after an incident like that will just say, I want to take some time off.
Yes.
Right? Because it's a big deal. So I want to go ahead and talk about lender's policies and owner's policies and what the distinction is between the two. Can you tell me what they are? Because we do require them in a real estate transaction where we have a lender involved.
Yes. And the differences are pretty cut and dry, but it's pretty simple. The owner's policy is a policy that the seller buys to ensure that when the property is transferred, the new buyer is getting clear title. The lender's policy is a policy that the buyer buys to ensure that there are no liens, judgments, things like that against them, the buyer, and that the deed of trust is in first position.
Perfect. And in this situation, the term policy refers to an insurance policy, correct?
Correct.
So let's go back a little bit and explain what an insurance policy for homes really covers. In the case we've already discussed, any liens outstanding, right? Now, I know after reading a preliminary title report, the important prefix pre, right? Mm-hmm. Meaning it's not final.
Right.
They say in the notes, we have no reason to believe we will not insure this property.
Correct.
However, we will continue to do investigation upon issuance of the final policy. Correct. And what that basically means is that when you have coverage for this, it protects the homeowner, mm-hmm. whoever the new homeowner is, against any, I don't know, Uncle Bob from five generations back having this recorded thing that he has in his hand, or even not recorded, that says he lays claim to this particular piece of your parcel.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, and you're able to say, no, we have all of these transfer documents. We have these policies protecting our interests in this. It allows us to issue this policy, but the insurance is there if needed. And there have been noted cases where you had to pay out.
Absolutely. Right?
But we also are doing this for mutual benefit and protection. If anything, I think California is a very litigious state. Mm-hmm. So they will sue you for anything, mm-hmm. and you want to be protected. And part of that is having proper insurance policies in place. So the next question is really who's protected through this process. I think it's everybody involved, specifically the buyer, the seller, the lender. Those are the three big parties when it's dealing with what I deal with, mm-hmm. on a day-to-day basis. So we talked about this briefly, but how do we discover if there's outstanding liens against an individual? What's it called? What's the name of the report that you guys run, a request for information?
We request a statement of information or a statement of identity.
Correct. That's
and
what I had.
That information is anywhere from their name, where they were born, social security number, driver's license number, their addresses for the last 10 years, their jobs for the last 10 years, if they have minor children, their children's names, because there could be child support liens out there. People don't understand that when a judgment is filed, it goes on your name, whether it's recorded or not. So when we run those names, social security numbers, things like that, we come up with information that we have to make sure is not belonging to our seller or our buyer, so we don't pay somebody else's bills.
Absolutely. So on the statement of information or statement of identity, I just filled one out yesterday with a client. And this one happened to be a for sale by owner transaction, so we had to do it, you know, in our office for that. But it goes back a minimum of 10 years.
Correct.
They're looking at name, date of birth, social, addresses last 10 year, occupation, previous marriages, if any, mm-hmm. the name of your spouse. The reason why this is important is we have common names out there.
Absolutely.
So, for example, if you have a last name Smith, or the last name Martinez, or the last name Chan, you may have a lot of them throughout the state of California, across the country. I remember a noted case about 7 years ago where somebody had a child support lien for over $26,000 in New Hampshire. The child was actually 30 years old by now. And it was amazing that they found that because our reports didn't show it, but it showed up on your guys' title search. Because what I'm finding out very quickly is that they're very interconnected. You guys have access to records that are not necessarily public record, meaning easily searchable through the internet searches, but you guys pay for access to these databases.
Absolutely.
And it also creates for us another level of security to make sure that we're lending on somebody that's not going to have a lien or judgment put on their property right away.
Absolutely.
So that's really very important. And I think the listeners of this podcast need to understand the importance of getting that statement of information sent out as quickly as possible in the early part of your transaction, because I don't like to see people get to the end of a transaction only to have a little headache.
Well, and it's people don't understand why we need all that information. Usually once you sit down, you explain it to them, and you put it in the manner of, if something comes up under this name and it's not yours, we don't want to take your money and pay it for someone else.
Sure.
And then they understand more why we want this information. We are just like a bank. We have security measures at every single level. So we try to reassure people not to worry. If we get your social, your driver's license number, things like that, they are absolutely secure in all of our systems.
Absolutely. And when you're going through that process, you guys run reports, like I said, a little more sophisticated as far as depth of what you run. We as lenders run reports as well. Very recently, within the last year and a half, they removed public record data like judgments to show up on credit reports. Bankruptcies are still showing there, but outstanding judgments are not, because they had a lot of false positives, meaning they had a name match perhaps or a city match, and they were putting them on people's credit reports, and it was really tanking transactions. So we run supplemental reports when somebody gets into transaction, but we ask on the application, it's very simple, do you have any outstanding judgments, liens, or collections against your name? We really trust our consumer to tell us the truth on that, right? So it does ask on the questionnaire on the last page called declarations, are there any outstanding judgments, liens, or collections? But it also asks, are you obligated to pay alimony, child support, or separate maintenance? And you'd be shocked, because some people, well, I did. Well, do you owe any past amounts? And they say yes or no. So we have to really trust our clients. We're not calling anyone being dishonest. But if something pops up, we have to then defend it and say yes or no. This is me or this is not me. Please provide proof so we can document it.
Well, and I think, too, people think that if they don't say anything, nobody will find it. And unfortunately, it does get found. And so if we know about it up front, if we know what's going on, we can deal with the issue so the transaction is not held up.
Absolutely. So our reports, we use something called Data Verify. It is through the credit bureaus, but they have these databases similar to yours, but it only goes back 10 years. So I have a scenario I'm going to tell you that we just closed about a month and a half ago, and it was kind of shocking to me, but not as surprising as I think people may, you know, think it would be. But so married couple, would have been married since I'd say 2013, but this is their second marriage, and the wife is selling the property that she has owned for the last 25 years, takes a tremendous amount of equity out of that property because she's owned it for so long, right? And she and her new husband are purchasing another piece of real estate. Well, upon discovery of the requirement for the statement of information, they said, well, we'll get to that, we'll get to that, we'll get to that. We're in the last week of the transaction. They find out that they have to go into the doc signing, and they fill it out then. Well, guess what we found? We found federal tax liens for taxes owed for the new husband dating back to 2003, 2004, and 2005. The amounts in total were over $20,000. So herein lies the problem. Because of their negligence in going in quick enough, these things were found out the 11th hour. We as the lender had no record of it. The loan was fully approved. They actually signed loan documents. They're ready to wire their closing funds. And there was a heart-to-heart that had to happen with the clients. And it was something like this. Yes, you can cancel. You're likely going to lose your deposit and all the monies that you've put into the transaction so far. But we can cancel the transaction. You will then start renting, and you'll still owe this federal amount. Now, I know your intention was, with a part of your proceeds from the sale of your property that you've owned for 20 plus years, was to pay off your vehicle. The vehicle was about $13,000 to $14,000. Or you can go ahead and buy this house that you guys have been wanting to purchase, that was now a house with you two together. No previous memories of the old home that you shared with an ex-husband. It's now your home together. It has the RV parking. It has all the things that you really were looking for. And it's going to cost you $20,000 to complete. Fortunately, you do have the funds to complete that. But you have to make that decision. Mm-hmm. Because you could be renting for the next 2 years while you try to pay those other things. And ultimately, it will be paid because the federal government's not going anywhere. And you have to make a decision. So after a long consideration and prayer time that they needed to kind of come to this decision, they said, we're going to do it. We'll pay it off. It's a new clean start. They still owe on the vehicle, but they afforded the vehicle payment regardless. But now that's never going to haunt them again.
Absolutely.
Right? And they're going to have clear title. So one of the things that happened in this transaction is that we had to deal with an IRS collection agent.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not the fastest to respond to anything. So if you want something done yesterday, it's going to cost you money in a sense. There is no discount. There is no waiver of penalties and fees and late expenses and all this stuff. And it took a little bit of time and finagling to push that through. Now, I give this example only because these are things that happen when you don't follow instructions early enough in a real estate transaction that could potentially cause a lot of heartache. Very fortunately, in this transaction, they had enough proceeds from her sale to pay that lien off.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just one of those things that happens out there.
Absolutely.
And we really just need to be on our game, because everything that I did in the loan process was perfect up until that point. But there are things that were undiscovered. And it's really frustrating, but it is what happened. So at this time, I want to shift gears. There is a report or request for transfer. They call it a PCOR, right? A preliminary mm-hmm. change of ownership report.
Correct.
Request, excuse me. What does that do, and who reads it, and why is it important?
Actually, it's very important. A PCOR is for the assessor's office. A PCOR tells the assessor what the property was sold for, if the people are going to live in the property, what kind of financing there is, if the property's in good, fair, poor, or really, really, really bad condition, whatever it is. And all these things matter to the assessor's office because of the records they keep. So if we are doing a transaction, the PCOR is signed by the new owner, and it will have the sales price, whether the people are living in it, and what's going on, okay? If you are transferring the property between, say, yourself and your son, you still need a PCOR. Because if you tell them the reason you are doing it is because it's between family members, the property may not be reassessed. The PCOR is very important so that when it goes to the assessor's office, it determines the tax that's paid and if the property is reassessed. Very important.
Yeah. And I know that incomplete PCORs or change of ownerships that do not have accurate data, it raises a red flag.
Yes.
And it causes the assessor to give you a call or potentially knock on your door, because they need to find out how that transfer took place, because they're either looking for additional assessment or they need to correct their records for tax rolls.
And remember too, the assessor will ask you if you are transferring between family members, or you tell them that you are, they will send you something and ask you information. They'll want names, they'll want social security numbers, they'll want dates of birth, they'll want all of these things to verify that that person truly is your family member.
Sure.
Because people have taken advantage, and the assessor's office is not going to put up with that.
Yeah. And this is of late. I'd say the last 10 years, it's been more
yes.
noticeable, because the amount of fraud that happened
yes.
between, say, 1999 to about 2014. It's just really, it's amazing what people are getting themselves into.
Yes.
So that kind of leads me into the next conversation. We hear this wonderful phrase called wire fraud. What is that?
Wire fraud is bad people taking good people's money. It's actually a very sad thing that the crooks have nothing better to do but sit around and figure out how they're going to hack someone's email and try to get money from someone that, you know, is innocent in the whole process. We are very, very, very strict about how we wire money in, how we wire money out. Our wiring instructions will never be given over email, because emails have been hacked, and I'll tell you a little story. But emails have been hacked. We do not, if someone calls us and gives us wiring instructions, we will write them down, and then we will call them back on a number that we know is good and verify that, because we've had people call in and change the instruction and think that they were going to get the money, and it wasn't really the buyer or the seller.
So let's give a quick example of what wire fraud actually does. So on my side as a lender, we are wiring hundreds of thousands of dollars on a single transaction that is generally handled directly between the funder and the escrow officer or the title officer to ensure those funds have a strong direct connection so the money sent is received.
Correct.
Right? Now, in the instance between consumer and the title company or escrow officer, that is where that chain has broken down in the past.
That is exactly it. And here's a little story for you. It's a very sad story, but it really did happen. There was a couple in Colorado. They had saved $600,000. They were buying their dream home. They were so excited they were buying their dream home. And the buyer, the couple, got this email that said, "Hey, I know we're supposed to close next week, but if you go ahead and send your wire now, send your money now, we'll give you a discount on your title policy and your escrow fees so we can have everything ready to go, da da da." So the people were like, "Okay, hey, we get a discount, that's fabulous." So they went down to the bank, they took the wiring instructions that were emailed to them, they emailed their $600,000 to that person. That person was not the title company.
Oh my goodness.
The crook had mimicked the title company's email signature, those kinds of things. If you looked at the where it was coming from, the email address, it was just a tad off. But if you just glanced at it, you wouldn't see it. And those people were out $600,000. Now, we're getting better at it. We've had some in our office locally that we have been able to catch, and the criminals don't get the money. But it's amazing how brash they are. They will call, keep calling and say, "Where's my money? Where's my money? Where's my money?" It's amazing.
Yeah,
very sad.
You know, one of the most tragic things in my mind is that when people think about real estate, those players that are involved, I call them players, but just individuals that are involved, the loan officer, the real estate agent, the title escrow, this is a process that we go through literally hundreds of times throughout the year. Mm-hmm. A consumer that is buying a property or selling a property may do this once mm-hmm. in their entire life. They may do it five times through their lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And to them, it's very, very important.
It's their life.
Exactly. So I think when we disconnect ourselves from the fact that these are real families, real lives that are being affected, is the time that we really need to reconsider what we're doing, because it's important. What we do actually has an impact on people's lives.
Yes.
And it just breaks my heart to hear that a family or, you know, a couple that saved their whole life to buy their dream home because of someone's selfish nature and fraudulent activity took advantage of them mm-hmm. and the technology that's available today. So it's very, very important. Listeners of this podcast, always, always, always triple confirm with your escrow officer to make sure that funds are going to the correct place. Do not accept odd things that pop up that seem to be too good to be true or something that seems a little off. It's not common with the communication triangle that you've gone through with the particular involved parties. Just always question. And if you're working with me, call me. I'm here to help. Come to my office.
And one more thing is, don't ever take wiring instructions from your real estate agent. We will never send them to your real estate agent.
Sure.
Because we want to protect your real estate agent
sure.
as much as we want to protect you. So always, always deal with your escrow officer.
Yes, absolutely. One thing I want to ask right now is there are common ways to hold title.
Mm-hmm.
Can we go through that real quickly? And what does it mean by holding title?
Holding title is what we call vesting. And the way you hold title will determine what happens to the title, what happens to the property if someone passes, how the property is dispersed. So typically, we see husband and wife as joint tenants. Joint tenants means that if one of the parties passes, it automatically goes to the other party. There's no tax involved. There's no deeds. There's no anything. And it's not just husband and wife that can hold it like that. Anyone can. I can hold title with my children all as joint tenants. So if I pass, they automatically get it. Trusts are another way, another thing, vehicle that can pass property on without a lot of problem. if you're going to do a trust, I sincerely think that you should use an attorney to put that trust together. I know that some of these legal Zooms and things have trusts that you can do, but they do not always encompass all the things in your situation. But a trust can be a very, very good vehicle to take care of disposing of property without a lot of problems. California Community Properties Day, if you do not say how you hold title, it's going to be community property. And if one of you dies, the other person has to go to court and they have to probate your interest. Mm-hmm. There's different things. You can have community property with right of survivorship, which means it's technically very close to what joint tenants is. It's just the community property while you're still alive is still in effect. There's a lot of different ways, and I have lots of information on it. So I tell people, lenders, if you don't know, they don't know what they're going to do, ask me. I'll give them all the paperwork. They can read it. They can make a decision for themselves. They can ask their accountant. They can ask their attorney. But don't just willy-nilly say, oh, yeah, I'll do that, if you don't know what it means.
Yeah. It's better to ask.
Absolutely.
And it's better to consult with a qualified professional.
Yes.
I give this example all the time, but I'm not qualified as a tax professional. So I may give you some information based off of my knowledge, but I always, always recommend you speak with a licensed tax professional for that type of advice. And the same thing applies here. When you're making, when you're signing a deed of trust and you're signing a loan, promissory note, you're signing a legal document.
Mm-hmm.
And it does have tax ramifications if done incorrectly. It also has legal ramifications if it's defaulted on. So you owe it to yourself to do it correctly.
Yep.
So you definitely want to deal with people that have experience, but more important, that have your best interests in mind and they're professional about it. I'm not saying that, you know, everything needs to be just completely cut and dry, but you have to have somebody that can explain it to you in plain English as well. Because a lot of these things come through, you're just not used to doing. So we want to recommend that you talk with a qualified professional to go through that. So we've made it to the tail end of our podcast. I want to kind of ask you, do you have any of those oops moments or horror stories from title and escrow that you say, man, had I had to do it again, I probably would have done it this way instead of that way. So do you have any quick stories?
I'm going to give you one that happened not too long ago. There was a family, and they had a piece of property. And they transferred the property. One brother had it. He transferred it to the other brother. Then that brother decided that he didn't want it anymore, so they transferred it to their son. And then he didn't want it anymore, so they transferred it to the sister. And then she decided, no, it's not for me. I'm going to give it back to the first guy. Okay? So it's first guy, Mr. Brother A. He goes to sell the property. He gets a buyer, cash buyer, boom, we are good to go. Well, we now have to, since none of those transactions were insured, we have to deal with all of those people. We had to get statements of information from all of those people, run all of their names, and get affidavits from all of them that they really did do this and this is what they wanted to do. Which, Brother B was good, Brother C was good, Cousin D was okay, but when it came back to sister was married. And although sister was only entitled for a couple of weeks, we had to run sister and her husband.
Why though?
Because it's a community
property.
That's
right, because California has a community property requirement.
So we run their names, and it turns up with they owe couple hundred thousand dollars in child support.
Oh.
Now, the property sold for $125,000.
Mm.
So the seller comes to me and he goes, well, what can I do? And I said, well, you can pay the $125,000 on their child support and hope that the district attorney's office, the child support division, will give you a partial release, or you can keep the property. He goes, but I don't want the property. I want to sell it. I said, I'm sorry. Unless you pay that and get a partial release, you can't. And he goes, well, when am I ever going to sell the property? And I said, when those people pass away.
Oh, wow.
because in their lifetime they will never pay off all that child support.
It was
just a tremendous amount, and unfortunately this man is stuck with this piece of property until and that's why we tell people, do not transfer property between brothers and sisters, kids and parents. Talk to an attorney. If we see that an attorney has done it and there is a reason for it, then that makes us more understanding and acceptable of the fact. But just in between people that they just do themselves, it always has to be investigated.
Wow. That is a pretty crazy story, and I believe it.
Yep.
Only because I have seen preliminary title reports that have seen multiple transfers. One of the note items is this particular property has had so many transfers in the last 24 months, right? Mm-hmm. So it is important for us to know as a lender. But if there are transfers beyond that time frame, it doesn't necessarily report on that prelim right away. So you guys are doing the additional background investigation, especially when you're selling real estate. Are there any other things that you've seen that have happened wonky, either close to the end of a transaction or even the setup of a transaction that maybe was an oops moment that could have been prevented?
How about after the transaction?
Let's hear one of those.
Okay.
I need popcorn here. Hold on.
There was a duplex on a piece of property, and sold the property, brought us the escrow with an address and an APN number. We do the escrow. Everything's peachy keen, no problemo. So then come to find out, the property was on two parcels. The real estate agent didn't realize that. No one realized that. So now we have another parcel that, number one, taxes have not been paid, and number two, was not transferred to the new owner. They came back to us. This is not a title issue. It was more of an uh-oh, what do we do? So we assisted the agent, we assisted the buyer in contacting the old seller, drawing deeds, getting things taken care of, so indeed the new person, the new buyer, did have title to all the whole property and get everything taken care of.
Yeah, I'm gonna say that kind of stuff I think is not common.
Not common.
But it does happen.
Absolutely.
And I remember several years ago during one of your talks with us as a business group, you made mention of really old legal descriptions of property. So there is actually a title department in the county that we live in where there are actually physical records that are housed, right? And back in the day, they were all cataloged, you know, manually for as long as records go back.
They're large books,
yes,
that have handwritten entries in them, yes.
And then it went to microfiche, right? Mm-hmm. Then it went into searchable catalogs, and now everything's pretty much online. But they still can go back to the original books as necessary for, you know, memorializing whatever is necessary. So I remember you telling us that there were legal descriptions of, what was it, 500 feet to this particular tree.
It was 500 feet. It started at the big red oak tree.
There you go.
And it went from the big red oak tree to the end of the corral post, and then from there to the granite rock. But it's amazing, some of those markers are still there.
Sure.
Because I saw some of those markers. It's very interesting.
And it really has to do with unimproved land.
Yes.
We didn't have, in California specifically, the same setup maybe in master plan. The East Coast has a lot much older history of real estate than we do here in California.
Yes.
And the stakes to land were really, truly stakes. They literally placed the stake and said, I own this piece from this stake to this stake. And they had to have some description.
Mm-hmm.
And landmarks were typically the way that they did that. So that's just really interesting to me. And even older parts of our community here, the river has always been a marker for location.
The river has, but the river has not always been where the river
is. Exactly. That's what I was going to point out, is that through erosion and time and just nature, things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And as they start to develop things, these things kind of get muddied, excuse the pun, but they've been changed. And because it's been dynamic in that sense, things need to be updated.
Yes.
So this is not related specifically to title and escrow, but it is a part of what you do. You work with the city planning and county development in parcel maps and all the things that go in legal description.
Yes.
So have there been situations where you guys have had to challenge them to actually go to the site and either measure or define clearly the boundaries of this particular piece of property?
Yes, and we will call in a civil engineer, and a civil engineer will go out and survey. If someone doesn't understand, if they think that something is off, if they're doing a lot line adjustment, if they're doing a lot line, a lot merge, anything like that, they will have a civil engineer go out and measure and survey exactly where it is.
And yes. Those types of things have implications on the yes. what you're actually purchasing yes. or what you're selling, correct?
Yes. It's funny you talk about documents, old documents. I was working with a gentleman who's doing some, an engineer who's doing some work up on the dam mm-hmm. in Lake Isabella. And he needed an old document regarding some riparian rights. And we searched it back, between he and I, we searched it back all the way to the 1900s. Early 1900s, where we had already given water rights to Los Angeles County.
Oh my goodness.
Very, very interesting.
So was that ever transferred for value of the repair and rights for that particular section?
There was a lot had gone on since.
Yeah.
But it was very interesting that even back then, they were making those deals and doing those things.
Yeah. Well, it's just important. I think that the history of real estate is pretty rich in California, specifically
yes.
because of the changes in our size and our population now. Well, Cecile, we went through a lot of stuff in a very short amount of time. I really enjoyed this conversation. I know the listeners of this podcast may have additional questions. I always welcome feedback. If they wanted to reach out to you to ask a question, what is the best number to reach you at?
Best number to reach me at is 661- 319-3851.
Perfect. And do you have anything else you want to say on the podcast before we end this?
If you are buying or selling a home, a business, or a mobile home, please go through title and escrow. It will save you headaches in the long run.
Absolutely. Thank you so much again, Cecile. I really appreciate your time and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks.